Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. Democracy Now! Is committed to bringing you the stories and perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. From the peace activists demanding an end to war, to indigenous leaders fighting to stop fossil fuel extraction and save the planet. Our independent reporting is only possible because we're funded by you, not by the weapons manufacturers when we cover war or gun violence, not by the oil, gas, coal, or nuclear companies when we cover the climate crisis. We count on your generous support to keep Democracy Now! Going. Please make your donation of $5, $10, or more at democracynow.org. Every dollar counts. Thank you so much. We're counting on you. Stay safe. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
So once the president had gotten into the vehicle with Bobby, he thought that they were going up to the Capitol, and when Bobby had relayed to him, we're not, we don't have the assets to do it, it's not secure, we're going back to the West Wing. The president reached up towards the front of the vehicle to grab at the steering wheel. Mr. Engel grabbed his arm, said, "Sir, you need to take your hand off the steering wheel. We're going back to the West Wing. We're not going to the Capitol." Mr. Trump then used his free hand to lunge towards Bobby Engel. And when Mr. Renato had recounted this story to me, he had motioned towards his clavicles.
Former White House aide Cassidy Hutchinson accuses Donald Trump of attacking his own presidential Secret Service agent on January 6 after he refused to drive Trump to the Capitol to join the armed mob gathering to block Congress from continuing the 2020 election results. We'll bring you highlights of the dramatic testimony before the House January 6 committee when she also reveals Trump urged security officials to stop using magnetometers to screen for weapons just prior to the violent attack on the Capitol, and that Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and Rudy Giuliani both sought pardons after the insurrection. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. An explosive testimony, a former White House aide accused Donald Trump of attacking his own presidential security detail on January 6 after the Secret Service refused to drive him to the Capitol to join the armed mob gathering to block Congress from counting Electoral College votes. The testimony came from Cassidy Hutchinson, a former top aide to White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. Speaking to the January 6 House Committee, Hutchinson described being told what happened inside Trump's presidential limo, which is known as the Beast.
The president reached up towards the front of the vehicle to grab at the steering wheel. Mr. Engel grabbed his arm, said, "Sir, you need to take your hand off the steering wheel. We're going back to the West Wing. We're not going to the Capitol." Mr. Trump then used his free hand to lunge towards Bobby Engel. And when Mr. Renato had recounted this story to me, he had motioned towards his clavicles.
The January 6 committee also aired video testimony from Hutchinson, where she revealed Trump urged security officials to stop using magnetometers to screen for weapons at his rally on January 6, just prior to the Capitol insurrection.
I was in the vicinity of a conversation where I overheard the president say something to the effect of, "You know, I don't effing care that they have weapons. They're not here to hurt me. Take the effing mags away. Let my people in. They can march to the Capitol from here. Let the people in. Take the effing mags away."
Moments later, Trump took to the stage and urged his supporters to fight like hell and march to the Capitol. Hutchinson also unveiled more details about how top Trump associates knew in advance of possible violence January 6. Mark Meadows, who's refused to testify before the House committee, told Hutchinson on January 2nd, January 6 would be really, really bad. Hutchinson said Meadows and Trump attorney Rudy Giuliani later sought pardons after the insurrection. At the end of the Tuesday hearing, committee vice chair Liz Cheney presented evidence of possible witness tampering by Trump allies. We'll have more on Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony after headlines. In Texas, the number of people who died after being confined inside a sweltering tractor trailer in San Antonio has risen to 51. All the victims are believed to have crossed the U.S.-Mexico border seeking refuge. 46 people were found dead in the truck Monday, while 5 more died after being taken to local hospitals. On Tuesday, the Mexican president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, addressed the mass deaths.
I want to express my deepest condolences to the family of the Mexican, Guatemalan, and Honduran migrants who died yesterday, asphyxiated in a trailer. It is a tremendous disgrace. These unfortunate events have to do with the situation of poverty and desperation of our Central American and Mexican brothers and sisters. It happens because there is also human trafficking and lack of controls at the border between Mexico and the United States and in the United States.
In other news from Texas, a state court has temporarily blocked a century-old abortion ban from going into effect. The Center for Reproductive Rights said the decision will allow abortion services in Texas to resume at some clinics, at least for now. At a NATO summit in Madrid, Spain, President Biden's announced plans to greatly expand the U.S. military presence in Europe, including building a permanent headquarters for the U.S. 5th Army Corps in Poland and deploying more troops to Romania and the Baltic region. Biden said this is part of a broader NATO expansion.
And together, our allies, we're going to make up sure that NATO is ready to meet threats from all directions across every domain, land, air, and the sea.
This comes as Finland and Sweden move closer to joining NATO after Turkey lifted its opposition to their membership. NATO summit is expected to focus on Russia's invasion of Ukraine, as well as the growing power of China. For the first time, NATO has invited the leaders of Japan, South Korea, Australia, and New Zealand to attend a NATO summit. Voters went to the polls for primaries in Colorado, Illinois, Maryland, New York, Oklahoma, and Utah Tuesday. Runoff elections were also held in Mississippi and South Korea. In New York, Governor Kathy Hochul won the Democratic primary, with New York City public advocate Jumaane Williams placing second. In Illinois, the Trump-backed Republican Congressmember Mary Miller defeated fellow incumbent Rodney Davis. Miller's election comes just days after she praised the Supreme Court's ruling overturning Roe as a victory for white life, unquote. In Colorado, far-right Republican Congressmember Lauren Boebert, who also was endorsed by Trump, fended off a challenge from a more moderate Republican. On Sunday, she spoke at a church in Colorado where she criticized the separation of church and state.
The church is supposed to direct the government. The government is not supposed to direct the church. That is not how our founding fathers intended it. And I'm tired of this separation of church and state junk that's not in the Constitution. It was in a stinking letter, and it means nothing like what they say it does.
In related news, the Supreme Court ruled Monday against a public school district in Washington state that suspended a high school football coach who insisted on conducting team prayers on the field after games. In their dissent, the court's 3 liberal judges warned that the ruling, quote, strikes at the core of our constitutional protections for the religious liberty of students and their parents. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court's reinstated a Republican-drawn congressional map in Louisiana that was found by a lower court to violate the Voting Rights Act by diluting the political strength of black voters. Michigan's Supreme Court has thrown out charges against former Michigan Governor Rick Snyder, his former health director, and 7 other former officials for their role in the deadly Flint, Michigan water crisis. The court ruled 6-0. The judge who issued the indictments did not have the authority to do so. Colombia's Truth Commission has estimated over 450,000 people were killed in Colombia between 1985 and 2018, during a time when the United States was a key backer of the Colombian military and right-wing paramilitaries, which targeted leftist groups, social justice leaders, and union members. The Truth Commission's report denounced the U.S.-funded war on drugs in Colombia, stating, quote, the consequences of this concerted and largely U.S.-driven approach led to a hardening of the conflict in which the civilian population has been the main victim, unquote. This is Reverend Francisco DeRue, who led the Truth Commission.
To the government, public forces, political parties, entrepreneurs, churches, educators, and other decision makers in Colombia, we ask you to recognize the drug trafficking penetration in our culture, in the state, politics, and economy, and face it as a nation. We must develop investigative tools to face the alliances, system, and involved interests. And we must change the war politics that attack those who are the weakest link, the farmers.
In more news from Colombia, at least 51 people were killed and over two dozen others injured Tuesday in a prison fire that started after prisoners set mattresses ablaze to protest conditions inside the dangerously overcrowded facility in the Cauca Valley. The building is old and reportedly did not have a working fire suppression system. In the Philippines, the independent news outlet Rappler has been ordered to be shut down by the Philippine Securities and Exchange Commission. Rappler's founder, the Nobel Peace Laureate Maria Ressa, has vowed to fight the order, which comes in the final days of Rodrigo Duterte's presidency. On Thursday, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., the son of the late Filipino dictator, will be inaugurated as president. And a warning to our audience, the following headline contains graphic description of sexual abuse. The British socialite Ghislaine Maxwell has been sentenced to 20 years in prison for helping Jeffrey Epstein recruit and sexually assault teenage girls. In December, she was convicted on five charges, including sex trafficking of a minor. Prior to the sentencing, Sarah Ransom, a survivor of Epstein's abuse, spoke to reporters.
I spent the last 17 years in my own prison for what she, Jeffrey, and all the co-conspirators did to me. I was raped repeatedly. I was raped three times a day sometimes. And I was not the only girl on that island. There was a constant stream of girls being raped over and over and over again.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Bombshell after bombshell. That's how Public Citizen described the dramatic testimony at Tuesday's surprise hearing of the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6 attack on the United States Capitol. The star witness, Cassidy Hutchinson, longtime close aide of Mark Meadows, the former President Trump White House chief of staff at the time of the insurrection. Hutchinson was questioned for about 2 hours by the Republican vice chair of the committee, Liz Cheney, and clips from Hutchinson's previous testimony to the committee were also featured, her deposition testimony. Today, we bring you extended highlights of the explosive revelations. This is Vice Chair Cheney.
We will begin today with an exchange that first provided Ms. Hutchinson a tangible sense of the ongoing planning for the events of January 6th. On January 2nd, 4 days before the attack on our Capitol, President Trump's lead lawyer, Mr. Giuliani, was meeting with White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and others. Ms. Hutchinson, do you remember Mr. Giuliani meeting with Mr. Meadows on January 2nd, 2021?
I do. He met with Mr. Meadows in the evening of January 2nd, 2021.
And we understand that you walked Mr. Giuliani out of the White House that night, and he talks to you about January 6th. What do you remember him saying?
As Mr. Giuliani and I were walking to his vehicles that evening, he looked at me and said something to the effect of, "Cass, are you excited for the 6th? It's going to be a great day." I remember looking at him and saying, "Rudy, could you explain what's happening on the 6th? He had responded something to the effect of, "We're going to the Capitol. It's going to be great. The president's going to be there. He's going to look powerful. He's going to be with the members. He's going to be with the senators. Talk to the chief about it. Talk to the chief about it. He knows about it."
And did you go back then up to the West Wing and tell Mr. Meadows about your conversation with Mr. Giuliani?
I did. After Mr. Giuliani had left the campus that evening, I went back up to our office and I found Mr. Meadows in his office on the couch. He was scrolling through his phone. I remember leaning against the doorway and saying, "I had an interesting conversation with Rudy, Mark. Sounds like we're going to go to the Capitol." He didn't look up from his phone and said something to the effect of, "There's a lot going on, Cass, but I don't know. Things might get real, real bad on January 6th.
Ms. Hutchinson, Mr. Meadows is engaged in litigation with the committee to try to avoid testifying here. What was your reaction when he said to you things might get real, real bad?
In the days before January 2nd, I was apprehensive about the 6th. I had heard general plans for a rally. I had heard tentative movements to potentially go to the Capitol. But when hearing Rudy's take on January 6th and then Mark's response, that evening was the first moment that I remember feeling scared and nervous for what could happen on January 6th. And I had a deeper concern for what was happening with the planning aspects of it.
Thank you, Ms. Hutchinson. Today, we're going to be focusing primarily on the events of January 5th and 6th at the White House. But to begin and to frame the discussion, I want to talk about a conversation that you had with Mr. John Ratcliffe, the Director of National Intelligence. And you had this conversation in December of 2020. Mr. Ratcliffe was nominated by President Trump to oversee U.S. intelligence, our U.S. intelligence community. And before his appointment, Mr. Ratcliffe was a Republican member of Congress. As you will see on this clip, Director Ratcliffe's comments in December of 2020 were prescient.
My understanding was Director Ratcliffe didn't want much to do with the post-election period. Director Ratcliffe felt that it wasn't something that the White House should be pursuing. It felt it was dangerous for the president's legacy. He had expressed to me that he was concerned that it could spiral out of control and potentially be dangerous, either for our democracy or the way that things were going for the 6th.
When you say it wasn't something the White House should be pursuing, what's the event?
Trying to fight the results of the election, finding missing ballots, pressuring filing lawsuits in certain states where there didn't seem to be significant evidence, and reaching out to state legislatures about that. So pretty much the way that the White House was handling the post-election period, he felt that there could be dangerous repercussions in terms of precedent set for elections, for our democracy, for the 6th. You know, he was hoping that we would concede.
So, Ms. Hutchinson, now we're going to turn to certain information that was available before January 4th and what the Trump administration and the president knew about the potential for violence before January 6th. On the screen, you will see an email received by Acting Deputy Attorney General Donahue on January 4th from the National Security Division of the Department of Justice. Mr. Donahue testified in our hearings last week. The email identifies apparent planning by those coming to Washington on January 6th to, quote, occupy federal buildings and discussions of, quote, invading the Capitol building. Here's what Mr. Donahue said to us.
We knew that if you have tens of thousands of very obsessive people showing up in Washington, D.C., that there was potential for violence.
The U.S. Secret Service was looking at similar information and watching the planned demonstrations. In fact, their intelligence division sent several emails to White House personnel, like Deputy Chief of Staff Tony Ornato and the head of the President's Protective Detail, Robert Engel, including certain materials listing events like those on the screen. The White House continued to receive updates about planned demonstrations, including information regarding the Proud Boys organizing and planning to attend events on January 6th. Although Ms. Hutchinson has no detailed knowledge of any planning involving the Proud Boys for January 6th, she did note this.
I recall hearing the word Oath Keeper and hearing the word Proud Boys closer to the planning of the January 6th rally when Mr. Giuliani would be around.
On January 3rd, the Capitol Police issued a special event assessment. In that document, the Capitol Police noted that the Proud Boys and other groups planned to be in Washington, D.C. on January 6th and indicated that, quote, unlike previous post-election protests, the targets of the pro-Trump supporters are not necessarily the counter-protesters as they were previously, but rather Congress itself is the target on the 6th. Of course, we all know now that the Proud Boys showed up on January 6th, marched from the Washington Monument to the Capitol that day, and led the riotous mob to invade and occupy our Capitol. Ms. Hutchinson, I want to play you a clip of one of our meetings when you described a call on January 4th that you received from National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien on the same topic, potential violence on January 6th.
I received a call from Robert O'Brien, the National Security Advisor. He had asked if he could speak with Mr. Meadows about potential violent words of violence that he was hearing that were potentially going to happen on the Hill on January 6th. I had asked if he had connected with Tony Ornato, because Tony Ornato had a conversation with him, with Mark, about that topic. Robert had said, I'll talk to Tony, and then I don't know if Robert ever connected with Mark about the issue.
Ms. Hutchinson, can you describe for us Mr. Ornato's responsibilities as Deputy Chief of Staff?
The Deputy Chief of Staff position at the White House for operations is arguably one of the most important positions that somebody can hold. They're in charge of all security protocol for the campus and all presidential protectees, primarily the president and the first family, but anything that requires security for any individual that has presidential protection, so the chief of staff or the national security advisor, as well as the vice president's team too. Tony would oversee all of that, and he was the conduit for security protocol between White House staff and the United States Secret Service.
Thank you. And you also described a brief meeting between Mr. Ornato and Mr. Meadows on the potential for violence. The meeting was on January 4th. They were talking about the potential for violence on January 6th. Let's listen to a clip of that testimony.
I remember Mr. Ornato had talked to him about intelligence reports. I remember Mr. Ornato coming in and saying that we had intel reports saying that there could potentially be violence on the 6th.
You also told us about reports of violence and weapons that the Secret Service were receiving on the night of January 5th and throughout the day on January 6th. Is that correct?
That's correct.
There are reports that police in Washington, D.C. had arrested several people with firearms or ammunition following a separate pro-Trump rally in Freedom Plaza on the evening of January 5th. Are those some of the reports that you recall hearing about?
They are.
Of course, the world now knows that the people who attacked the Capitol on January 6th had many different types of weapons. When a president speaks, the Secret Service typically requires those attending to pass through metal detectors, known as magnetometers, or MAGs for short. The Select Committee has learned that people who willingly entered the enclosed area for President Trump's speech were screened so they could attend the rally at the Ellipse. They had weapons and other items that were confiscated: pepper spray, knives, brass knuckles, tasers, body armor, gas masks, batons, blunt weapons. And those were just from the people who chose to go through the security for the president's event on the Ellipse, not the several thousand members of the crowd who refused to go through the mags and watched from the lawn near the Washington Monument. The Select Committee has learned about reports from outside the magnetometers and has obtained police radio transmissions identifying individuals with firearms, including AR-15s, near the Ellipse on the morning of January 6th. Let's listen.
There's an individual who's in a tree, maybe a white male, about 6 feet tall, thin build, brown cowboy boots. He's got blue blue jeans and a blue jean jacket, and underneath the blue jean jacket, complainant also a stock of an AR-15. He's going to be with a group of individuals, about five to eight other individuals. Two of the individuals in that group at the base of the tree near the porta potties were wearing green fatigues, green olive trash style fatigues, about 5'8", 5'9", skinny white males, brown cowboy boots. They had Glock style pistols in their waistband.
8736 with the message that the object, weapon on his right hip. After that, he's in the tree.
Motor 1, make sure PPD knows they have an elevated threat in the tree outside of Constitution Avenue. Look for the Don't Tread on Me flag, American flag face mask, cowboy boots, weapon on the right side hip.
I got three men walking down the street in fatigue while carrying AR-15, copy at 14th and Independent.
AR-15s at 14th and Independence. As you saw in those emails, the first report that we showed, we now know was sent in the 8 o'clock hour on January 6th. This talked about people in the crowd wearing ballistic helmets and body armor, carrying radio equipment and military-grade backpacks. The second report we showed you on the screen was sent by the Secret Service in the 11 a.m. hour, and it addressed reports of a man with a rifle near the Ellipse. Ms. Hutchinson, in prior testimony, you described for us a meeting in the White House around 10 a.m. in the morning of January 6th involving Chief of Staff Meadows and Tony Ornato. Were you in that meeting?
I was.
Let's listen to your testimony about that meeting, and then we'll have some questions.
I think the last time we talked, you mentioned that some of the weapons that people had at the rally included flagpoles, oversized sticks or flagpoles, bear spray. Is there anything else that you recall hearing about the people who would gather on the Ellipse had?
I recall Tony and I having a conversation with Mark probably around 10 a.m., 10:15 a.m., where I remember Tony mentioning knives, guns in the form of pistols and rifles, bear spray, body armor, spears, and flagpoles. Spears were one item, flagpoles were one item, but then Tony had relayed to me something to the effect of, and these effing people are fastening spears onto the ends of flagpoles.
And Ms. Hutchinson, here's a clip of your testimony regarding Mr. Meadows' response to learning that the rally attendees were armed that day.
What was Mark's reaction, Mr. Meadows' reaction, to this list of weapons that people had in the crowd?
When Tony and I went in to talk to Mark that morning, Mark was sitting on his couch and on his phone, which was something typical. And I remember Tony just got right into it. I was like, sorry, I just want to let you know, and informed him, like, this is how many people we have outside the mags right now. These are the weapons that we're known to have. It's possible he listed more weapons off that I just don't recall. And gave him a brief but concise explanation, but also fairly thorough. And I remember distinctly Mark not looking up from his phone. And I remembered Tony finishing his explanation and it taking a few seconds for Mark to say his name, to the point where I almost said, Mark, did you hear him? And then Mark chimed in, was like, all right, anything else? Still looking down at his phone. And Tony looked at me, and I looked at Tony, and Tony said, no, sir, do you have any questions? He's like, what are you hearing? And I looked at Tony, and I was like, sir, we just told you about what was happening down at the rallies. And he was like, yeah, I know. And then he looked up and said, have you talked to the president? And Tony said, yes, sir, he's aware too. And he said, all right, good.
He asked Tony if Tony had informed the president.
Yes.
And Tony said, yes, he had.
So, Ms. Hutchinson, is it your understanding that Mr. Ornato told the president about weapons at the rally on the morning of January 6th?
That's what Mr. Ornato relayed to me.
And here's how you characterize Mr. Meadows' general response when people raised concerns about what could happen on January 6th.
So at the time, in the days leading up to the 6th, there were lots of public reports about how things might go bad. the six, even the potential for violence. If I'm hearing you correctly, what stands out to you is that Mr. Meadows did not share those concerns, or at least did not act on those concerns.
Did not act on those concerns would be accurate.
But other people raised them to him, like in this exchange, you mentioned that Mr. Arnotto pulled him aside.
That's correct.
Ms. Hutchinson, we're going to show now an exchange of texts between you and Deputy Chief of Staff Arnotto. And these text messages were exchanged while you were at the Ellipse. In one text, you write, "But the crowd looks good from this vantage point, as long as we get the shot. He was effing furious." And the text messages also stress that President Trump kept mentioning the OTR, an off-the-record movement. We're going to come back and ask you about that in a minute. But could you tell us, first of all, who it is in the text who was furious?
The he in that text that I was referring to was the president.
And why was he furious, Ms. Hutchinson?
He was furious because he wanted the arena that we had on the Ellipse to be maxed out at capacity for all attendees. The advance team had relayed to him that the mags were free-flowing. Everybody who wanted to come in had already come in, but he still was angry about the extra space and wanted more people to come in.
And did you go to the rally in the presidential motorcade?
I was there, yes, in the motorcade.
And were you backstage with the president and other members of his staff and family?
I was.
And you told us, Ms. Hutchinson, about particular comments that you heard while you were in the tent area.
When we were in the offstage announced area tent behind the stage, he was very concerned about the shot, meaning the photograph that we would get, because the rally space wasn't full. One of the reasons, which I've previously stated, was because he wanted it to be full and for people to not feel excluded because they'd come far to watch him at the rally. And he felt the mags were at fault for not letting everybody in. But another leading reason, and likely the primary reason, is because he wanted it full and he was angry that we weren't letting people through the mags with weapons, what the Secret Service deemed as weapons and our weapons. But when we were in the offstage announced tent, I was part of a conversation. I was in the vicinity of a conversation where I overheard the president say something to the effect of, "You know, I don't effing care that they have weapons. They're not here to hurt me. Take the effing mags away. Let my people in. They can march to the Capitol from here. Let the people in. Take the effing mags away."
Just to be clear, Ms. Hutchinson, is it your understanding that the president wanted to take the mags away and said that the armed individuals were not there to hurt him?
That's a fair assessment.
The issue wasn't with the amount of space available in the official rally area only, but instead that people did not want to have to go through the mags. Let's listen to a portion of what you told us about that.
In this particular instance, it wasn't the capacity of our space. It was the mags and the people that didn't want to come through. And that's what Tony had been trying to relay to him that morning. You know, it's not the issues that we encountered on the campaign. We have enough space, sir. They don't want to come in right now. They have weapons they don't want confiscated by the Secret Service, and they're fine on the mall. They can see you on the mall, and they want to march straight to the Capitol from the mall.
The president apparently wanted all attendees inside the official rally space and repeatedly said, quote, "They're not here to hurt me."
And just to be clear, so he was told again in that conversation, or was he told again in that conversation, that people couldn't come through the mags because they had weapons?
Correct.
And that people, and his response was to say they can march to the Capitol from the Ellipse.
Something to the effect of, "Take the effing mags away. They're not here to hurt me. Let them in. Let my people in. They can march to the Capitol after the rally's over. They can march from the Ellipse. Take the effing mags away. Then they can march to the Capitol."
Ms. Hutchinson, what we saw when those clips were playing were photos provided by the National Archives showing the president in the offstage tent before his speech on the Ellipse. You were in some of those photos as well. And I just want to confirm that that is when you heard the president say the people with weapons weren't there to hurt him and that he wanted the Secret Service to remove the magnetometers.
That's correct. In the photos that you displayed, we were standing towards the front of the tent with the TVs, really close to where he would walk out to go onto the stage. These conversations happened 2 to 3 minutes before he took the stage that morning.
Let's reflect on that for a moment. President Trump was aware that a number of the individuals in the crowd had weapons and were wearing body armor. And here's what President Trump instructed the crowd to do.
We're going to walk down, and I'll be there with you. We're going to walk down. We're going to walk down anyone you want, but I think right here we're going to walk down to the Capitol.
And the crowd, as we know, did proceed to the Capitol. It soon became apparent to the Secret Service, including the Secret Service teams in the crowd, along with White House staff, that security at the Capitol would not be sufficient.
Vice Chair of the committee, Liz Cheney, questioning Cassidy Hutchinson, the close aide to Mark Meadows, President Trump's White House chief of staff. When we come back, Cassidy Hutchinson accuses Donald Trump of attacking his own presidential Secret Service agent January 6th after the agent refused to drive Trump to the Capitol to join the armed mob gathering outside Congress. Stay with us.
I fight to breathe through hunger, not greed. I find these days it's the only way I can survive.
Two Worlds Collide by Inspiro Carpets. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we bring you highlights of Tuesday's surprise hearing of the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. We return to Cassidy Hutchinson, the former close aide to Trump's White House Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, questioned by Republican Committee Vice Chair Liz Cheney about what happened January 6th when then-President Trump's motorcade left the so-called Stop the Steal rally, where Trump had encouraged his armed supporters to march on the Capitol.
Ms. Hutchinson, when you returned to the White House in the motorcade after the president's speech, where did you go?
When I returned to the White House, I walked upstairs towards the chief of staff's office, and I noticed Mr. Renato lingering outside of the office. Once we had made eye contact, he quickly waved me to go into his office, which was just across the hall from mine. When I went in, he shut the door, and I noticed Bobby Engel, who is the head of Mr. Trump's security detail, sitting in a chair, just looking somewhat discombobulated and a little lost. And I looked at Tony, and he had said, "Did you effing hear what happened in the Beast?" I said, "No, Tony, I just got back. What happened?" Tony proceeded to tell me that when the president got in the Beast, he was under the impression from Mr. Meadows that the off-the-record movement to the Capitol was still possible and likely to happen, but that Bobby had more information. So once the president had gotten into the vehicle with Bobby, he thought that they were going up to the Capitol, and when Bobby had relayed to him, "We're not, we don't have the assets to do it, it's not secure, we're going back to the West Wing," the president had very strong, very angry response to that. Tony described him as being irate. The president said something to the effect of, "I'm the effing president, take me up to the Capitol now." To which Bobby responded, "Sir, we have to go back to the West Wing." The president reached up towards the front of the vehicle to grab at the steering wheel. Mr. Engel grabbed his arm, said, "Sir, you need to take your hand off the steering wheel. We're going back to the West Wing. We're not going to the Capitol." Mr. Trump then used his free hand to lunge towards Bobby Engel. And when Mr. Renato had recounted this story to me, he had motioned towards his clavicles.
And was Mr. Engel in the room as Mr. Ornato told you this story?
He was.
Did Mr. Engel correct or disagree with any part of the story for Mr. Ornato?
Mr. Engel did not correct or disagree with any part of the story.
Did Mr. Engel or Mr. Ornato ever after that tell you that what Mr. Ornato had just said was untrue?
Neither Mr. Ornato nor Mr. Engel told me ever that it was untrue.
And despite this altercation, this physical altercation, during the ride back to the White House, President Trump still demanded to go to the Capitol. Here's what Kayleigh McEnany, the White House press secretary at the time, wrote in her personal notes and told the committee about President Trump's desire to go to the Capitol after returning to the White House.
When you wrote POTUS wanted to walk to the Capitol, was that based solely on what the president said during his speech or anything that he or anybody else said afterwards?
So to the best of my recollection, I believe when we got back to the White House, he said he wanted to physically walk with the marchers. And according to my notes, he then said you'd be fine with just riding the beast. But to the best of my recollection, he wanted to be a part of the march in some fashion.
Okay. And just for the record, the beast refers to the presidential limousine?
Yes.
President Trump did not go to the Capitol that day. We understand that he blamed Mark Meadows for that.
So prior to leaving the rally site, when he got off the stage and everybody was making the movement back to the motorcade, I had overheard Mr. Meadows say to him then, as I had prior to Mr. Trump taking the stage that morning, that he was still working on getting an off-the-record movement to the Capitol. So when Mr. Trump took the stage, he was under the impression by Mr. Meadows that it was still possible. So when he got off the stage, I had relayed to Mr. Meadows that I had another conversation with Tony. The movement was still not possible. Mr. Meadows said, okay. And then as they proceeded to go to the motorcade, and Mr. Meadows had reiterated, we're going to work on it. So I talked to Bobby. Bobby has more information. Mark got into his vehicle, to my understanding. Trump got into the beast. And after we had all arrived back at the White House, later in the day, it had been relayed to me via Mark that the president wasn't happy, that Bobby didn't pull it off for him, and that Mark didn't work hard enough to get the movement on the books.
The physical altercation that Ms. Hutchinson described in the presidential vehicle was not the first time that the president had become very angry about issues relating to the election. On December 1, 2020, Attorney General Barr said in an interview that the Department of Justice had not found evidence of widespread election fraud sufficient to change the outcome of the election. Ms. Hutchinson, how did the president react to hearing that news?
Around the time that I understand the AP article went live, I remember hearing noise coming from down the hallway, so I poked my head out of the office. And I saw the valet walking towards our office. He had said, get the chief down to the dining room. The president wants him. So Mark went down to the dining room and came back to the office a few minutes later. After Mark had returned, I left the office and went down to the dining room, and I noticed that the door was propped open and the valet was inside the dining room changing the tablecloth off of the dining room table. He motioned for me to come in and then pointed towards the front of the room near the fireplace mantel and the TV, where I first noticed there was ketchup dripping down the wall and there's a shattered porcelain plate on the floor. The valet had articulated that the president was extremely angry at the Attorney General's AP interview and had thrown his lunch against the wall, which was causing them to have to clean up. So I grabbed a towel and started wiping the ketchup off of the wall to help the valet out. And he said something to the effect of, he's really ticked off about this. I would stay clear of him for right now. He's really, really ticked off about this right now.
And Ms. Hutchinson,
Was this the only instance that you are aware of where the president threw dishes?
It's not.
And are there other instances in the dining room that you recall where he expressed his anger?
There were several times throughout my tenure with the chief of staff that I was aware of him either throwing dishes or flipping the tablecloth to let all the contents of the table go onto the floor and likely break or go everywhere.
And Ms. Hutchinson, Attorney General Barr described to the committee the president's angry reaction when he finally met with President Trump. Let's listen.
And I said, look, I know that you're dissatisfied with me, and I'm glad to offer my resignation. And he pounded the table very hard. Everyone sort of jumped, and he said, accept it.
Voice, the last voice you heard was Trump's Attorney General, William Barr. We'll have more of Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony in 30 seconds. Strange Overtones by David Byrne and Brian Eno. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman as we bring you highlights from the dramatic testimony of Tuesday's surprise hearing of the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6 attack on the United States Capitol. Star witness Cassidy Hutchinson described how her then-boss, White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, reacted to the rioters storming the Capitol on January 6. She was questioned by Republican Committee Vice Chair Liz Cheney.
Not long after the rioters broke into the Capitol, you described what happened with White House counsel Pat Cipollone.
No more than a minute and a half later, I see Pat Cipollone barreling down the hallway towards our office and rushed right in, looked at me, said, is Mark in his office? And I said, yes. He just looked at me and started shaking his head and went over, opened Mark's office door, stood there with the door propped open, and said something to the Mark is still sitting on his phone. I remember like glancing and he's still sitting on his phone. And I remember Pat saying to him something to the effect of, the rioters have gotten to the Capitol, Mark, we need to go down and see the president now. And Mark looked up at him and said, he doesn't want to do anything, Pat. And Pat said something to the effect of, and very clearly had said this to Mark, something to the effect of, Mark, something needs to be done or people are going to die and the blood's going to be on your effing hands. This is getting out of control. I'm going down there. And at that point, Mark stood up from his couch, both of his phones in his hand. He had his glasses on still. He walked out with Pat. He put both of his phones on my desk and said, let me know if Jim calls. And they walked out and went down to the dining room.
A few minutes later, Representative Jordan called back.
A couple minutes later, so likely around between 2:15 and 2:25. I know the tweet went out at 2:24. I don't remember if I was there when the tweet went out or if it happened right afterwards, but Jim had called. I answered the phone. Said, one second, I introduced myself, but I don't remember if he called my cell phone or if he had called one of Mark's. But I answered the phone and said, one sec, Mark's on the hall, I'm going to go hand the phone to him. He said, okay. So I went down, I asked the valet if Mark was in the dining room. The valet said yes. I opened the door to the dining room, briefly stepped in to get Mark's attention, showed him the phone, like flipped the phone his way so he could see it said Jim Jordan. He had stepped to where I was standing there holding the door open, took the phone talking to Jim with the door still propped open. So I took a few steps back. So I probably was 2 feet from Mark. He was standing in the doorway going to the Oval Office dining room. They had a brief conversation, and in the crossfires, I heard
briefly like what they were talking about, but in the background, I had heard conversations in the Oval dining room at that point talking about the Hang Mike Pence chants.
That clip ended, Ms. Hutchinson, with you recalling that you heard the president, Mr. Meadows, and the White House counsel discussing the Hang Mike Pence chants. And then you described for us what happened next.
It wasn't until Mark hung up the phone, handed it back to me. I went back to my desk. A couple minutes later, him and Pat came back, possibly Eric Hirschman too. I'm pretty sure Eric Hirschman was there. But I'm confident it was Pat that was there. I remember Pat saying something to the effect of, Mark, we need to do something more. They're literally calling for the vice president to be effing hung. And Mark had responded something to the effect of, you heard him, Pat. He thinks Mike deserves it. He doesn't think they're doing anything wrong. To which Pat said something, this is effing crazy. We need to be doing something more. Briefly stepped into Mark's office. And when Mark had said something, to the effect of, he doesn't think they're doing anything wrong, knowing what I had heard briefly in the dining room, coupled with Pat discussing the Hang Mike Pence chants in the lobby of our office, and then Mark's response, I understood there to be the rioters in the Capitol that were chanting for the vice president to be hung.
Let me pause here on this point. As rioters chanted, Hang Mike Pence, the president of the United States, Donald Trump, said that, quote, Mike deserves it, and that those rioters were not doing anything wrong. This is a sentiment that he has expressed at other times as well in an interview with ABC News correspondent Jonathan Carl. President Trump was asked about the supporters chanting Hang Mike Pence last year. Instead of condemning them, the former president defended them.
Hang Mike
because
Pence.
It's common sense, John. It's common sense that you're supposed to protect. How can you, if you know a vote is fraudulent, right?
Yeah.
How can you pass on a fraudulent vote to Congress?
President Trump's view that the rioters were not doing anything wrong and that, quote, Mike deserved it, helps us to understand why the president did not ask the rioters to leave the Capitol for multiple hours. In fact, he put this tweet out at 2:24 p.m. Ms. Hutchinson, do you recall seeing this tweet in which the president said the vice president did not have the courage to do what needed to be done?
I do.
And Ms. Hutchinson, what was your reaction when you saw this tweet?
As a staffer that works to always represent the administration to the best of my ability and to showcase the good things that he had done for the country, I remember feeling frustrated, disappointed, and really, it felt personal. It was really sad. As an American, I was disgusted. It was unpatriotic. It was un-American. We were watching the Capitol building get defaced over a lie.
Star witness Cassidy Hutchinson goes on to talk about Donald Trump's response to the insurrection. She's questioned by the House Committee Vice Chair Liz Cheney.
Inside the White House, the president's advisors, including members of his family, wanted him to deliver a speech to the country. Deputy White House Counsel Pat Philbin prepared the first draft of what would be the president's remarks on national healing, delivered via pre-taped video on January 7th. When he arrived at the White House on the 7th, Mr. Philbin believed that more needed to be said, so he sat down and started writing. He shared the draft with Pat Cipollone, who also believed the president needed to say more. Mr. Cipollone agreed with the content, as did Eric Hirschman, who reviewed the draft. The committee has learned that the president did not agree with the substance as drafted and resisted giving a speech at all. Ms. Hutchinson, do you recall discussions about the president's speech on January 7th?
I do.
Let's listen, Ms. Hutchinson, to what you told us about that and about the process of crafting those remarks.
I learned from a conversation with Mark and overhearing between him and White House counsel and Eric Hirschman as well that Trump didn't necessarily think he needed to do anything more on the 7th than what he had already done on the 6th. When he was convinced to put out a video on the 7th, I understand that he had a lot of opinions about what the context of that announcement were to entail. I had original drafts of the speech where there were several lines that didn't make it in there about prosecuting the rioters or calling them violent. He didn't want that in there. He wanted to put in there that he wanted to potentially pardon them. And this is just with the increased emphasis of his mindset at the time, which was he didn't think that they did anything wrong. The people who did something wrong that day, or the person who did something wrong that day, was Mike Pence by not standing with him.
Hutchinson also described how White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and Trump attorney Rudy Giuliani later sought pardons for the insurrection. Again, this is Vice Chair Liz Cheney.
Ms. Hutchinson, did Rudy Giuliani ever suggest that he was interested in receiving a presidential pardon related to January 6th?
He did.
Ms. Hutchinson, did White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows ever indicate that he was interested in receiving a presidential pardon related to January 6th?
Mr. Meadows did seek that pardon. Yes, ma'am.
In her closing statement Tuesday, House January 6th Committee Vice Chair Liz Cheney suggested witnesses Trump allies have been intimidating committee witnesses.
Our nation is preserved by those who abide by their oaths to our Constitution. Our nation is preserved by those who know the fundamental difference between right and wrong. And I want all Americans to know that what Ms. Hutchinson has done today is not easy. The easy course is to hide from the spotlight, to refuse to come forward, to attempt to downplay or deny what happened. That brings me to a different topic. While our committee has seen many witnesses, including many Republicans, testify fully and forthrightly, this has not been true of every witness. And we have received evidence of one particular practice that raises significant concern. Our committee commonly asks witnesses connected to Mr. Trump's administration or campaign whether they've been contacted by any of their former colleagues or anyone else who attempted to influence or impact their testimony. Without identifying any of the individuals involved, let me show you a couple of samples of answers we received to this question. First, here's how one witness described phone calls from people interested in that witness's testimony. Quote, what they said to me is, as long as I continue to be a team player, they know I'm on the right team. I'm doing the right thing. I'm protecting who I need to protect. You know, I'll continue to stay in good graces in Trump world. And they have reminded me a couple of times that Trump does read transcripts. And just keep that in mind as I proceed through my interviews with the committee. Here's another sample in a different context. This is a call received by one of our witnesses. Quote, a person let me know you have your deposition tomorrow. He wants me to let you know he's thinking about you. He knows you're loyal and you're going to do the right thing when you go in for your deposition. I think most Americans know that attempting to influence witnesses to testify untruthfully presents very serious concerns.
And we end with Donald Trump's former national security advisor, General Mike Flynn, who supported Trump's efforts to overturn the election. During Tuesday's hearing, the House committee aired excerpts of its video deposition with Flynn, who repeatedly refused to answer questions from House committee Vice Chair Liz Cheney.
Do you believe the violence on January 6th was justified morally?
Take the fifth.
You believe the violence on January 6th was justified legally?
Fifth.
General Flynn, do you believe in the peaceful transition of power in the United States of America?
The fifth.
The fifth. So said President Trump's former National Security Advisor, General Mike Flynn, in videotaped testimony. He was answering the questions of committee vice chair, Congressmember Liz Cheney. If you want to see the full surprise hearing yesterday that lasted about 2 hours with Cassidy Hutchinson with various deposition testimony like Mike Flynn, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.